David A. Price presents...
Hello, folks. Welcome to Marvel Noise, episode 443. I'm your host, Steve Raker, cosmically aware, along with my other selves, trapped in the negative zone, WW Whirlwind X Kevin and Andrew the L.A. Rabbit, floating freely.
Super Steve, I think we all know I'm the one trapped in the negative zone.
The negative zone again?
Marvel Noise is the semi-monthly Marvel-centric podcast proudly sponsored by nobody. You can find episodes past and present over on marvelnoise.com and get new show announcements and give us feedback on our Twitter, Facebook, or Blue Sky pages. We are part of Derek Coward's Diabolical Deliberate Noise Network, along with our sister show, Indie Comic Book Noise, where we talk indie comics. Aptly named show, that Indie Comic Book Noise.
Who would have figured?
What about the delightful Deliberate Noise Network? See, diabolical. You make it sound like it's not all rainbows and unicorns.
This episode, we are wrapping up our deep dive into writer Peter David's Captain Marvel run, having covered his first series on episodes 430, 434, 436, and the first half of the second series on episode 439, leaving us with issues 13 to 25 to finish out the string. These were published over 1 year from August 2003 to July 2004. And like the previous issues of the series, this second run here, the pages are shot directly from the pencils and then colored by Chris Sotomayor with inks without inks, like the inks are the colors. So you see a lot of pencil strokes in the, like where they're spotting blacks and stuff. It looks like someone colored it with a marker, kind of. It's a good effect sometimes and not so good other times.
Yeah, it kind of stands out now.
I mean, it worked really well, I think, with Chris Cross, original artist, right? I think that's why they were doing it. Just like that's why they were doing the whole Genus is Insane storyline was based off the fact that, man, Chris Cross draws some crazy looking faces, right? And then Cross is gone and they're stuck with the look of the book being shot directly from the pencil and a crazy Captain Marvel.
Yeah, I was kind of hoping they would have leaned into the crazy visual aspect more, not to spoil my, but I thought some of the design sort of ended up being more kind of regular instead of crazy out of your head designs, but maybe also wasn't testing well with the prime demographic.
We get a few different pencilers over these issues too, kind of by arc. And you know, when you're coming in on a series, do you really right from the get-go go way out there as far as your design? You know what I mean? I think people probably play it cool, but never were on it long enough to really feel comfortable enough to stretch.
Yeah, that was kind of the curse of the series. Like, you get a good artist, and then they're not on for that long, so.
Issue 13 has Michael Ryan providing pencils and a Chris Cross cover. This one's a done-in-one where there's an alien world where an occupying force that saved the planet's original inhabitants at one time have now outlasted their welcome, and they become oppressors themselves. So Marv shows up and teaches them a lesson, and they don't learn. But I thought it was fun how long and it was like a long joke, where like you know it's going somewhere and it does get there and it does stick the landing, but it's funny kind of how long they set up the whole thing where he kind of shows them by being taking what they're doing to an extreme so that they're suffering by the same situation, but they don't get it.
At least you get to see Burstar.
Yeah, this is where I thought, instead of kind of generic humanoid aliens, like some kind of crazy looking thing would have helped. Because you're right, it's like one bit that goes on and on and on. So by making it crazier looking, I think that would have ameliorated that feeling of, yeah, we all see the metaphor pretty quickly.
And Rick starts to wonder if Genus might be massaging his thoughts to kind of pacify his behavior, where he usually acts kind of as Genus's conscience. But he's not being as aggressive, for lack of a better term, and he's not getting on top of Marv about stuff. And he's starting to wonder if Marv is doing stuff to him. He is.
And we're still firmly in the Rick is super yoked, goes to the gym all the time.
Yeah.
Maybe takes some supplements on the side, if you know what I mean.
Issue 14 is also Michael Ryan pencils and has a really nice Howard Porter, Mark Morales cover. So when Genus remade the universe, when we talked about it in episode 439, it wasn't perfect, and there are like some anomalies that remain. And he manages to charge one of these anomaly areas and get some crazy results. This issue, it is three versions of Rick Jones and three versions of Genus. So they can, you know, have some introspective confrontations
with themselves.
Yeah, and also, again, I like that they not only made current Rick Jones, but Bucky era Rick Jones super ripped too, which, you know, maybe slightly different than he was done way back when.
And you have the boozing
yeah,
Captain Marvel legacy Genus.
Yep. And then the pre-going crazy hero, Captain Marvel, who can't believe what his current self is up to.
Yeah.
And long-haired Genus. Why would I have cut my hair so short? And he gets his ponytail yanked, and it's like, that's why.
It's also kind of funny that super powerful, all cosmically aware, kick-butt current Captain Marvel uses his weird little laser gun too. It feels like,
yep,
it's I mean, they need it to help have it be the metaphor for what he wants to the other guys to do and everything. But still, it seems on some level pretty silly that
it's
he's
the
using
death
it.
Stare, right? It's the death stare. It's the mind bullets, but it takes physical form by him. Every time he uses the gun, it's great, I think. Issues 15 to 18 are a four-issue Crazy Like a Fox arc with Paul Azaceta pencils. Not my favorite with this printing situation, but he is definitely a solid storyteller. I was never in question what was going on or anything.
How about that cover, too?
Issue 15.
Neil Adams cover.
Yeah. Very cool. And a cool one, too, with like, so all the Neil Adams faces in the crowd and that Genus walking around in that Kree uniform that looks so cool. The races of the galaxy, like the Shi'ar and the Kree and the Skrulls, they hold a big powwow to figure out how to solve a problem like Captain Marvel.
The only thing it was missing, Steve, was the inside cover should have had the cutout explaining who all the people were, like the Superman versus Mom, all the celebrities Neil slides in.
And he's got Rick so controlled now with the mind warping stuff that he just commands him to leap to his death out off a balcony, and he does. pretty harsh.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is the era of, like, I thought they did a decent job, but I really don't. I mean, I get leaning into it, but the all-powerful character, they also are going to bring in some of the, like, personified forces of the universe, the life and death or meaning, they bring people back and all that. Not my favorite setting, but I thought they did a pretty good job with it. I'm just generally not, I feel like less is more with that, because it does feel like the stakes are kind of lesser when they openly are kind of admitting, like, oh yeah, we can just pull whoever we want back from the dead or give them clones or nothing can hurt them or that sort of thing. Does cul-de-sac the storytelling in certain ways.
At least they established that he, because in two issues prior, he killed Burstar and brought him back. So kind of when he did it, I was like, oh yeah, all right, at least he's bringing people back here. But he annihilates the Badoon, then wipes out the combined attack fleet of the Shi'ar Korean Skrulls. Then Genos appears to them, like, at the council and says that he's seen the future and their union leads to this dictatorship. And to prevent that from happening, they're all dead in a week. And then his long-lost mother appears.
What? Right up
in front of the council there and everything. Issue 16 starts, it has a Barry Kitson cover. And Genos, as you can imagine, does not take the confrontation with his mother well. Again, the use of the gun, right? It's like, I've had enough. But he runs off to Mar-Vell's grave and again encounters Epiphany, the sister of Entropy or whatever, who became Eternity when they did the whole rebuild the universe thing.
Yeah, they were good in those early issues. So I'd forgotten that they came back and did some stuff again. Or do they? Maybe he's just hallucinating.
Well, then Genos has an epiphany and brings Rick back, but it's just as he was, like, getting a Viking funeral. So he's on a slab and the fire is burning around him and he's got to, like, get out of there. But, of course, doing so makes the crowd see him as a, you know, some sort of mythical figure. Don't we all, though? Genos can't figure out this whole mother appearing thing, and he heads off to Titan to find out what's what. Issue 17 and 18, actually, both have covers by Tom Fleming.
Well, I will say I love that they're ending all these with, like, the surprise. The first one ends with Mom. The second one ends with his clone sister. So I do think, like, as a month, I mean, I'm reading these in order, so it's not like I have the month to month, but I could see how, oh yeah, you know, we're going to end with this little cliffhanger-y introduction thing each time. And I imagine that was fun for the people, you know, 20 years ago reading these off the rack, which wasn't me.
In issue 17, Genos faces Rick's wrath. And questions himself, really, because Rick can't see or hear Epiphany like he can. And so he's got these two voices, kind of the angel and devil over his shoulders, you know?
We're doing that whole bit again. Remember, Marlo was had the ghost, and then they're like, no one can see me until they could.
And they also like, they always like a few weird little jokes, too.
Yeah.
Some fourth wall stuff. I like the opening has a guy just in the background, but with like a clerk shirt. I mean, it says clerks, but it's clearly the clerks design. Like just fun little throwaway bits like that, littering it, which I enjoy. Although sometimes you feel like it's a weird tonal shift if they're trying to have some heavy thing and then there's silly jokes in it. But I like silly jokes, so it works for me.
Yeah, like, you know, going to Titan and wait a minute, I thought Robin led the Titans, you know, that stuff that cracks me up. But when Genos reaches Titan, he finds his sister, Phyla, who he never met, but totally now remembers. Wait, what? And she's calling herself Captain Marvel. So this is the first appearance of Phyla Vell. Yeah, or is it the issue before when there's the one panel?
Kevin, what's the market saying to you on these? Which issue is the one?
I think issue 17 was the one that people were hot for in a minute.
So brother and sister fight, and they argue, and they fight, and Genus has a tantrum in light of it all. And his mother and Star Fox appear, but he's not listening to them either. And he opens one of those anomaly rift holes, and they get sucked in, but Phyla pulls Genus through too. Droop, as the issue ends. Issue 18 has Genus in a circus mindscape with Rick as the ringleader. And talk about background gags and stuff.
Full of throwback to the Hulk being ensnared by the circus of crime and everything.
Daredevil doing the bow arrow with the apple on Elektra's head. And then later in the issue, you see Elektra's like with an arrow in her head thrown over a car.
Yeah, I knew you would have loved Thanos being there with Death, but for other people, they might enjoy Impy being there with Father Zemo.
Yeah, I thought you'd get a kick out of that, Kevin. And then I got to figure that the Punisher, who was earlier, you know, like pulling him back into it.
So in this finale of the Crazy Like a Fox arc, the Titans break him. And then basically cure him. So he adopts this new white costume and pledges to do good. And the galaxy is, you know, partially relieved. But Rick and Epiphany are both still loud voices in Genus's head.
So, Kevin, you have this Marvel legend with the white suit now? We're tracking all the different toy versions.
No, that should have been one that.
That would probably be the Marvel Unlimited renewal figure.
Oh my God, that's exactly what I was going to say. Issues 19 to 24 are a 6-issue odyssey with art by Aaron Lopresti in the first 4 issues.
I thought his worked pretty well with this style of.
Oh, yeah.
Shooting from with the color art and everything, maybe better than some of the other ones, but the corny, this one starts pretty corny with Rick's song. It's really just, this book really took a lot of weird chances.
But no one is seeking Marv's services. He's setting himself up like a Ghostbusters kind of a thing, or a midnight mission, come to me, call if you need help, and no one's calling. Phyla's still hanging around, and future Marlowe shows up, attacks, and burns out in a really weird sequence, and Rick begs Marv to help make sure that this destiny never comes to be for Marlowe.
He's got his first client, Steve.
Yep. Issue 20, with a crisscross cover, has Genus traveling to the future to change Marlowe's fate. And he finds and merges with his future old disabled self. Because this merged squadron of Kree, Badoon, Shi'ar, and Skrull are attacking. Just like he foresaw that they would band together and be a oppressive dictatorship in the galaxy.
Oh, you're right, Kevin. I totally missed. This is old man Captain Marvel.
Of course it is.
And he's got a kid, you know, a bearded, grumpy kid. And Genus has Phyla protect Marlowe and Moondragon while he's off in the future. And the Captain Marvel in the future, old man Marvel, and the kid have future Marlowe in stasis. She had some kind of disease where she was in chirogenic suspended animation. So Marv needs to go further into the future. In issue 21, because he's combined with his old self, he's at both his most powerful and his most knowledgeable.
Love this outfit redesign with like the crazy shoulders and the little half hood and all that. This is one. This is the type of thing I kind of like. I'm like, yeah, give me some of this design.
And he kicks butt and takes names, but it's actually all done in an instant in all of the attackers' heads. It's a violent but non-violent attack. Crazy. Also, the Magus appears, the purple evil version of Adam Warlock, and tries to capture Marlowe through her mirror, but Moondragon and Phyla save her.
Well, at least it wasn't through the toilet. You know, you get to watch out for those toilets.
That hair of the Magus, too, would be good through the toilet. Issue 22 has Genus traveling further into the future, where he's mocked as an imaginary god, mixing him up with different myths and fables, like Prometheus Bound on the splash page.
Boy, Earth really doesn't do well in the future, Steve.
No, he's got to stop this from happening. That's why he was going to kill the Kree and the... Anyway, he encounters his immortal but otherwise powerless son in this future. But Marlowe is missing.
Doesn't that statue remind you of, like, is it that Superman story or that Watchmen story? You know, some of those...
Yeah. Like, whatever happened to the Man of Tomorrow thing.
Yeah.
His son knows where Marlowe is, but is able to resist Genus's cosmic awareness. So he changes into Rick, and Rick beats the crap out of this guy instead. But then he gets incinerated, because this guy does have powers. After all, he's a pyrotechnic.
Also, they did go with the Moondragon. This, like, kind of her classic look, but...
Yeah.
Sort of a lighter green. Yeah. I'm not reading these on the Unlimited, so not sure how it came out. But I was like, boy, I kind of like that sort of...
It's pretty good.
...light green. This is a nice design. She was always a character I was sort of neither here nor there on, so I'm up for, you know, tweaks and redesigns.
Marlowe, to protect Marlowe, Phyla brings her to Titan. And the Magus attacks Moondragon back on Earth, claiming she's the one he really wanted all along. Wah, wah, wah. Issue 23 and issue 24 have Pat Quinn pencils, but both have crisscross covers.
Starting to think maybe we can't trust the Magus, Steve.
Yeah, right. Rick wakes up even further into the future. Fortunately, the incineration caused him to further time jump. He's got no negabands. The sun has them.
But and now Genus, we're in the Planet of the Apes, apparently.
Right. Genus guides Rick towards them, so he begins this Bedouin-like journey across the desert. But a fun twist, the only history that's left is the history that Doom left. So it's like Dr. Doom's version of history is the only one that is remembered. Issue 24 has Rick encountering future Marlowe and the Negaband-wearing Sun. And actually, he's working to free the Magus. He's working with the Magus all along. So it's all tied in with current-day Marlowe, too. They're outside the wreckage of the Titanic in the desert. And the Sun attacks and brings Genus forth. The Sun wanted to do battle with his father so that the energy from the both of them would be a conflict so great that the Magus would be able to be freed. And ties into the whole history thing, right? Like he keeps talking about wanting to be remembered in history and that kind of thing.
Yeah. And then they do a Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure time solution that's very grim.
Yeah, Genus refuses to fight, instead makes a decision that makes his son fade away, and it's the Hitler conundrum. Genus kills his son in his crib. Although it was going to be like he was going to choose to not, have him in the first place. But it's kind of worse to let him be a little baby and loved and everything and then kill him, isn't it?
I thought there was a whole bit a few issues earlier about how he can't just travel willy-nilly around time for some story reason. I'm like, well, I guess he can just travel wherever the story needs him to travel.
Well, no, I think
that's
why
he kept going forward.
I think that was
bit about.
But then they
go back.
Right. Well, they all went back for the one. You know, they went back to, continue on in the Marvel Universe kind of a thing. But he's just dealing with the angst of the fact that someday he will kill his son. And that little interlude where they show it happening, it was just for our benefit. Like, that wasn't, he didn't get to experience that yet. That was just like, someday. It was really grim. But Marlo is safe from that future. So, hey, mission accomplished.
There we go.
Moondragon.
Happy ending.
Is she part of the Magus's, you know, it's left on a ambiguous note a little bit. Like, maybe he corrupted her a little. We won't know. I like those kind of little seeds that maybe something, you know, a future team can do something with or not. Up to them.
Issue 25 is the final issue of both series and of Peter David's handling of Gina Zavell here.
Yeah, I remembered some stuff from this issue, but what I didn't remember was how the artwork is really Keith Giffen-y.
Oh, yeah, it's so good. I forgot, I was like, whoa, you know, I hadn't read a Keith Giffen comic in a minute, and I was just not, it's no knock on the prior teams, but I found it real refreshing to have,
yeah, it's pretty
old
good
school pencils and inks and all that stuff. I was like, this is cool.
It's Keith Giffen and Al Gordon, and I felt like it had it reminded me how much Eric Larson's take on Kirby is very similar to Keith Giffen's.
Yeah,
you know, there were a lot of panels where I'm like, ooh, this is very Larson-y. and it's Keith Giffen. Kind of cool. Moondragon and Marlo claim that their brief romantic fling was the result of the Magus's influence, which is really just said to repair Marlo and Rick's relationship. Phyla catches on, and she and Moondragon kind of flirt a little bit and then go off together, setting up that long romance that even after, like, Moondragon becomes a dragon and all that crazy stuff in the Abnett, you know, the DNA stuff. Crazy.
Yeah.
That was the seed of all of that.
And doesn't some of that stuff still play out in, in Infinity Wars or something? Like, these characters are still around.
Yeah, and it wasn't that long. I think not that. I was reading this Phyla, last time I read a comic with her in it, they were still a couple too, and
right.
That was probably 5 years ago or something, so it lasted for a while anyways.
Yeah, and now, then this comic gets pretty meta.
Yeah, Al, who used to work at Marlowe's comic store, he appears and reveals himself to be a cosmic being himself, Eulogy, and it's his job to tidy up when a book gets canceled. And so Genus is in disbelief, but unlike his cosmic awareness, Rick has comic awareness. He knows.
Rick should be used to that by now, though. He'll be like, oh, I'll be around in a new book, but who knows what my status quo will be.
Yeah, I love the artwork, so that worked, but I don't know. I just feel like this gets resorted to a lot, the meta thing in these superhero comics, but maybe it was fresh and new back then. I don't know.
Well, I mean, I think I found it better than, this is past Kevin, found it better than like the issues previous, but still wasn't exactly what I wanted. But I don't know. Maybe I'm more fond for it now. But I mean, for this series, it seems appropriate that they get weird and meta. I don't know if I found it back then to be like, Peter David being a bit angry at the audience, or this is why the book didn't sell.
Yeah, he does seem to blame the crowd a little bit.
Yeah, I mean,
Rick and Marlo walk off into the sunset through the portal, but before doing so, Marlo wishes away her wishing power.
There we go.
Ding. Well, that's wrapped up in one panel. But Genus, he holds out. He's waiting for that call. Someone's going to call him on the bat phone there, you know, on the Ghostbuster hotline. The call's not coming, though, so he finally steps through the door, and then after he steps through the door and the portal closes, ring, ring, ring.
Well, doesn't he have to get that call from one of the Thunderbolts to be boring?
But I thought it was a good ending. The old, they're, you know, on the, it's tradition for in some of the B or C titles to do the meta ending, right? Like when Kazar ends a title, or maybe She-Hulk ended her original title, or that kind of
thing. I remember the Animal Man, the Grant Morrison.
Yeah.
Had a whole long, it was more than the last issue, I think. It was a few where they wrapped it up that way.
Yeah. And then they have the whole bit where, like, the color's disappearing, the backgrounds are being carried off type of thing.
Yep.
Like, oh, yeah, you would have married Songbird and everything. And you're like, wait, what?
The grave, Captain Marvel's grave that they always would go to. They're like cleaning up the gravestone. It's all gotta go. Fun stuff, though. I thought it was a good ending to the series. I thought this whole second run here with the him being crazy and everything like that was way out there and worthy of it being its own series rather than just the next issues of the previous one. I thought it was a good enough ride, especially devouring all of it within like the last 6 months or so. I thought it was an all right enough direction to explore, and the storytelling was very different with having him being such a loose cannon, but having Rick being the conscience who can't really affect him except for those little mind stings that he could send him and that kind of a thing. That's a different type of a back and forth dynamic than we've seen in the past.
Yeah.
No, Andrew's not sold.
No, it was like I said, the problem is that the setup of omnipotent character, we're going to kill characters and bring them back and all, is generally not where I want my big two books to be, hang out that much in. And
agreed.
Go gentle with them. So for that setting, he did fine. But because it's not my jam generally, I was more vibing on like the art teams and some of the choices. And I think that, like I said, push those boundaries even further on a more like, and it's also my own. Rick Jones never did anything for me. I would have liked to see maybe some of the other team brigade members get some fights in there.
Well, you know, the rest of the line wasn't doing this. So like this wasn't what was the general storytelling that was happening. It wasn't happening. And, you know, when you say you don't want to have this in all your books, it wasn't. It was just in this book, and which made it weird and different. And it was fun reading it month to month. And I thought it was a good exercise to go back and read it in chunks and relive what we experienced off the shelves 20 years ago.
Oh, yeah. I mean, if you got the unlimited, it's totally a fun thing, but I wouldn't tell someone to go spend a bunch of money and run down the issues or anything.
Well, would you tell them to buy the omnibus?
Yeah, probably not. I'm not I don't really like, I think I've come around to omnibuses are too many issues. It's too heavy. And I have a lot of heavy books. So I don't like those big. I also feel their bindings are not great, and there's a lot of gutter loss and some of it.
It has to be sewn.
I have slowed down a lot on the omnibuses as well, but there's some that I just can't resist. And I was pleasantly surprised and pleased with the sizes of the recent Godzilla omnibus.
I was going to say ROM, but then the thing people is like, oh, well, you could have fit that into two volumes. I'm like, yeah, but then you're getting the big size again. So you got to pay them more money or we're going to get the big size.
Yep. I like the way they broke up the ROM. And then you got most of the Ditko, P. Greg Russell stuff, post-Earth kind of in the last volume. I thought that was good that way. And the Micronauts as well. I thought that was handled good. And I did pre-order the Marvel Fanfare omnibus, because how could I not?
Yeah,
I really like the
like good size.
I really like the epic editions. I think that's
oh yes.
If Me I too. Could pick a format for whatever to get reprinted in, I would always pick Epic. I feel that they're right. There are a lot of issues. They're well put together. They always pick a few nice, like they have some extra back mattery stuff they slide in.
A lot. I find they put a lot of stuff in there. Yeah, yeah. And I like that they don't do them chronologically, too. So it's not like, okay, we got to go through the whole first 100 issues of Spider-Man again. You know what I mean? Yeah. It's like bouncing around. So they've taken the time to map it all out, which I think is fun. And they do a good job with it, especially with the crossover issues and stuff like that. I'm really happy with those Epic collections, and I still find myself ordering them every once in a while here, filling in gaps.
Yeah, when I see them, I'm always like, yeah, that's the ticket. Yeah, the design. I'm just sad because, you know, at some point they're going to cancel it and move to some other format. Then you'll have half of them in that format and half in their new, whatever they call their new thing.
I don't know if you've noticed, but I guess the old ones did well enough that, like, the modern stuff is getting some epics now. So, I mean, I don't think it's going anywhere.
Yeah. I hope not. Oh, I picked up both the Spider-Gwens, too, as gifts for people. And it's just a nice, like you say, because they're doing some modern stuff, too. It's a good gift option. It's not too intimidating. Because I've also given... The other problem is, like, one time I gave one of those big omnibuses to somebody, and if they're not a comic book person, it is a little intimidating to have this giant thing. Where those, they look like it's a lot, but it's not an unmanageable amount.
Yeah.
You know, I just feel like it's a really smart compromise in size and space and all that.
Yeah. I know some people like those digests. Like, that's the hotness.
Yeah. My friend Jim Whiting is buying those digest reprints of the Masterworks. I don't know, a little too small.
Yeah,
I have to swear myself off of those.
The Michael Cho covers are nice, though.
Some of those early Silver Age Marvel reprints, what I'm like. I think those first 30-some-odd Spider-Man, I might have those in like five different formats. Like, you just keep... certainly the first like 12 issues of Spider-Man or whatever, I'm in 100 different ways or something. But maybe I'll check out these Romnibus ones if you guys say they're not too unwieldy from a reading perspective. Maybe I'll go grab one. I have some of that Avengers one that's the first whatever 30 or 40, and sometimes I grab it, but I just generally find it not super convenient a way to access the material.
Fair enough. All right, we did it. We wrapped up another deep dive by finishing off the Peter David Captain Marvel stuff. Yay!
And now for something completely different.
Whatever happened to all the fun in the world?
Stronger than a whale, he can swim anywhere. He can breathe underwater and go flying through the air.
The neighbor of Atlantis is the prince of the deep.
So I've had this side project reading all the Submariner solo stories in the Marvel Age of comics, not the original Golden Age stuff. Really, I wanted to read the Submariner's first ongoing series in its entirety, which I've never done. I mean, I've read a bunch of the issues, but not them all, and certainly not back-to-back in chronological order. But then I figured I should probably go back and read the split book tales to Astonish Stories 2, and kind of got bogged down with those serials, but covered that material beginning in January 2023 on episodes 405, 408, 416, 418, and most recently, if you can call it that, episode 428 from earlier this year in February 2024, where we finally transitioned from the Tales to Astonish to Submariner number 1 via that Iron Man Submariner one-shot special. That makes this our 6th installment of solo Submariner Tales, this time covering issues 2 through 7 of the Submariner from the first half of 1968.
Issues 2 and 3 were bi-monthly before the title went monthly with issue 4. When we last left Namor, Atlantis was destroyed, and Namor's in exile, and the Atlanteans are wandering the sea looking for a new site to settle and rebuild on. Namor has also faced a major foe, Destiny, who has claimed all sorts of insider knowledge about Namor, but had really vague goals, and his motives were unclear about what he needed Namor for, or why he knew what he knew about Namor, or... strange dude. So in February 1968, Issue 2 hits the stands. All these issues were written by Roy Thomas with pencils by Big John Buscema, with inks on issues 2, 3, 4, and 5 by Frank Giacoa, and then issues 6 and 7 with Dan Adkins. The issue number 2 has a great cover of Namor and Triton from the Inhumans fighting. The issue opens with Plant Man in a sub. He's just cruising around in his really cool sub, right? Because that's what supervillains do. They plot evil in their exotic lairs, right? But he's discovered in his sub by both Namor and Triton, but manages to trick the two into thinking that he's in cahoots with the other one. So then they fight, thinking that they're fighting, you know, like Plant Man's champion or whatever, or partner. We get to see Black Bolt and the Inhumans in cameos too, which is cool. And then in issue number 3, Namor and Triton get captured by Plant Man and eventually escape and then team up to fight his Leviathan, who was causing havoc over in the UK. Plant Man, major villain, with subs and giant city attacking kaiju-like Leviathans. Issue number 4 also has a great cover that shows Atuma putting a whooping on Namor with his horde cheering him on. Lady Dorma learns that Namor is alive in issue 4 and orders their fleet to turn and sail towards him. There's this dynamic splash page of Namor seeing Dorma, but it's just some seaweed-like vegetation that clouded his mind. Ouch. Lady Dorma, you look better than a floating pile of seaweed. Namor seeks Reed Richards of the Fantastic Four to help him in finding the villain Destiny. That's his mission. His destiny, if you will. But he gets sidetracked when some of Atuma's thugs confront Namor and then take him in. Atuma has the wandering Atlanteans enslaved and tells Namor that Lady Dorma's dead. Atuma is challenged by Namor to fight for supremacy, and despite Atuma cheating with this electrified armor, Namor defeats him. And then he frees and leaves the Atlanteans, still thinking Lady Dorma dead. Issue 5 has another great Big John cover, this one introducing Tiger Shark, who's standing menacingly over Lady Dorma. In issue 5, Namor arrives to the shores of New York and gets attacked by a giant robot that explodes just as Namor had it on the ropes, but he gets knocked unconscious. And he wakes as the prisoner of Dr. Dorcas, who's conducting a secret experiment to restore an injured Olympian swimmer to form after he had a back injury. Very noble and altruistic of Dr. Dorcas, right? The swimmer's sister is also there, kind of as like a support animal. Meanwhile, Lady Dorma hears Namor save them, but then left. And she heads out in this little solo submarine craft to go find him. And immediately almost dies encountering this giant squid and everything. Dr. Dorcas wasn't exactly forthcoming with this injured swimmer, as we can imagine. The swimmer's name was Todd Arliss. And the procedure siphons power and essence from the Submariner and a tank full of sharks and transforms Arliss into the Tiger Shark using his Morphotron, Arliss now even has like sharp teeth and everything. The tiger shark briefly tussles with Namor. Then he runs out of oxygen because he needs seawater. So he dives into the ocean. And what do you know? He lands right on the roof of Dorma's vessel, who was, you know, just driving by and everything. So now he's menacing her. Namor follows the tiger shark, sees Dorma alive, but after a mighty battle with tiger shark, Namor's bested and left under a bunch of rubble while the tiger shark runs off with Dorma as his captive. Issue 6, that begins the Dan Adkins inks over Buscema, really looks good. Arliss's sister Diane finds and revives Namor, and the tiger shark forces Dorma to lead him to the wandering Atlanteans, where he defeats the warlord Seth in a battle for the crown and takes charge, ruling with a brutal fist, as one might imagine. Meanwhile, the villain Destiny secures a base of operation and observes Namor and his via his Mento screen. And he's wondering why Namor's not, like, looking for him. He's not even swimming towards me. He's, like, going deeper off into the ocean. He's pretty disappointed. Namor storms through the construction of New Atlantis and confronts the tiger shark on the throne and challenges him to the battle for the crown. This is not the way to establish a government, I'm just saying, but here we go with the whole challenge thing. And after some wonderfully laid out and rendered pages by Buscema and Adkins, Namor is victorious and the ruler of Atlantis once again. And with Tiger Shark imprisoned, Namor vows to finally get around to tracking down that guy, Destiny.
Destiny! Destiny! No escaping! That's for me! Destiny! Destiny! No escaping! That's for me! Destiny.
In issue 7 from August 1968, the one with the Buscema Adkins photo cover of Namor flying through the city, Namor examines Tiger Shark, who's in captivity, and determines that he was driven aggressively mad by Doc Dorcas's experiments. He and Dorma head to the surface to tell Arliss's sister that he's still alive, but he's, you know, violently mad and needs to be incarcerated. Namor, while topside, stumbles upon Paul Destine running for office. He's turning the centrists against the far left and the far right, secretly using a hypno-helmet device. It's Destiny. They also show Destiny observing Namor, claiming that his sole goal is to destroy Namor. But why? And what's with this whole rule the world through these psychopolitics and everything? It's just, this guy never really had a clear mission. Namor tracks down Destiny and they do battle. He's a formidable foe, this guy. They fight on a rooftop and Namor gets hurled from it. Then Destiny removes his helmet in a moment of hubris and embraces the crowd below, oddly falling to his death as he reaches out for them. And that's the end of Destiny. Just not sure the payoff was worth the whole quest and everything. And how did he have the knowledge of Namor and all the secrets that Namor was going to pry from him and all the, like, just none of it made much sense. But with Namor's quest complete, it's a good enough place to pause. More to come when there's more to come. Thanks again to Andrew and Kevin, and for all you facing front out there in podcast land. Until Marlo and Moondragon switch hairdos, make mine Marvel. Later.